BBRSDA's Waypoints is produced by BBRSDA. Those things said on Waypoints don't necessarily reflect the views of KDLG staff, management, or board of directors.
Hello, welcome to our fourth episode of the Waypoints radio show, brought to you by the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association, or BBRSDA for short. Well, maybe not short, but a little shorter anyhow, you know, once you get the cadence down. BBRSDA is a fisherman's organization supported by the Drift Fleet that works to maximize the value of Bristol Bay's salmon fishery. If you don't know much about BBRSDA or have lost track of what it's doing, check them out at bbrsda.com once you're back from fishing. My name is Andy Wink. I'm BBRSDA's executive director, and I'm very excited about today's show. Most of you out there realize that abundance and sustainability are really what makes Bristol Bay so special and unique. Nowhere else on Earth do wild salmon thrive and reproduce like they do in Bristol Bay. And so understanding this resource and how to perpetuate it has a profound effect on all the fishermen who make their living in Bristol Bay. Today, we're going to discuss research operations, besides what the Alaska Department of Fish and Game does to manage the fishery, because it's the research and the field studies that really help us have a deeper understanding of the Bristol Bay salmon resource. So hopefully we can be good stewards and keep these fish stocks thriving for future generations. And I should point out that some of this research is financially supported by BBRSDA because we know fishermen care deeply about sustaining the resource and obtaining a deeper understanding of what makes it tick. We're really lucky to be joined by several incredible fishery scientists today. We have Dr. Curry Cunningham, a quantitative ecologist and associate professor with the University of Alaska Fairbanks. We also have with us Dr. Daniel Schindler, calling in from the Lake Nurka Field Station. Daniel is a UW professor with the School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences and an ecologist with decades of experience researching Bristol Bay salmon. Finally, we'll be talking with Dr. Ray Hilborn, a UW professor and fishery scientist, who's authored more than 200 peer-reviewed scientific papers and also brings decades of research experience involving Bristol Bay and other fisheries around the world. Thanks so much for being here, guys. Maybe the best place to start us off is by letting people know about the Alaska Salmon Program. You know, what is it, what are its goals, and how does it help Bristol Bay fishermen?
Okay, this is Ray. I'll answer that. Alaska Salmon Program is a collaborative program between the University of Washington and faculty from University of Alaska Fairbanks, whose goal is to understand the functioning of the Bristol Bay ecosystem, particularly with respect to the sockeye production, and to do science and training to facilitate the good management of the system. It was founded in 1946 when the dean of the College of Fisheries at University of Washington was asked to come up and look at the management by the major processing companies who were unhappy with the federal management system. And since then, the program, which used to be called the Fisheries Research Institute, or FRI, and we still use that a fair amount, developed many of the basic techniques that are used in management. The counting towers, the aging of fish from scales in the catch, and really set the scientific basis for when statehood came along and Alaska Department of Fish and Game really had tools they could use to manage the fishery. We maintain a series of five field facilities around Bristol Bay. We have people in the field really studying the ecosystem, but doing things like measuring the growth of juvenile fish, looking at the impacts of predation on the spawning fish, and walking many of the streams in the Wood River and Iliamna the system. And we've been consistently funded by the processing industry, and we're funded by as broad a range of sources as we can, including the National Science Foundation, BBRSDA, BBEDC. We had substantial funding from the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation, and we still have some funding from them. So we, you know, we're always trying to find new projects that we can find funding for. And I just mentioned that in addition to the research, training is a big part of what we do. And many of the staff at University of Alaska and at Fish and Game are former students of our program. Daniel, do you want to fill in anything I glossed over?
Yeah, one thing that I think is noteworthy of our program is the duration of time that we've been studying sockeye and their watersheds here in Bristol Bay. Lots of talk about climate change and what it might mean for salmon populations throughout the range. But because of longevity, because of the longevity of our records, both of the salmon and of their habitats, you know, we're in a very good position to start understanding how climate change in Alaska has and will likely continue to affect salmon production into the future. You know, if you read the or consume the public media, typically you hear lots of doom and gloom stories about the effects of climate change on ecosystems. And what's really clear from long-term records of Bristol Bay salmon is that as climate has warmed up, particularly beginning in the 1970s and again in the last decade, we've sort of jumped up one more step. Bristol Bay salmon systems have actually become more productive, and as climate has warmed, the number of fish these watersheds has produced continues to increase, and it's really one of the few bright spots for salmon watersheds and how they're responding to climate change throughout the range of salmon. So far, our records and other people's records indicate quite clearly that climate warming has actually increased the number of fish these watersheds are producing.
I just wanted to mention one program that probably that one of our activities that affects all the fishermen that, which is the escapement goals. And 10 years ago, Fish and Game proposed a major change in escapement goals and raising them quite a bit. And at that time, both the fishing fleet and the processing industry were very reluctant to see the escapement goals change this much. And BBEDC funded our group to really take a look at what the escapement goals in terms of what would produce the most value for the fishery. And we did a 2 or 3 year study. Curry was involved in that when he was a PhD student. And the net result is we proposed this method of sliding escapement goals. You have a lower escapement goal in a weak run, a higher escapement goal. And that study effectively was adopted by the Board of Fish as the current escapement goal. So that's something that really directly affects the fleet every year.
Yeah, thanks for pointing out. That's very interesting to, you know, think about it. What is the right escapement goal? And, you know, is more necessarily better, or is a lower escapement goal going to be more optimal for, you know, kind of maximizing the sustainable harvest yield? I want to get your guys' take on the forecasting efforts that are going on, because the FRI program does make preseason forecasts, and BBRSDA has invested in some of this research of applying artificial intelligence and machine learning protocols to see if forecasts can be tweaked and improved. And so maybe, Curry, could you kind of explain that in layman's terms and what you guys have found as you've been digging into this further?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So as you pointed out, the UW FRI program produces a preseason forecast for abundance of salmon returning to Bristol Bay every year in about November prior to the season, as does the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And part of what we do is try to look across different methods we might use to predict abundance for the next year, see which methods work and which don't, and try to select the optimal methods for predicting future returns. Now, with funding support from BBRSDA, we've taken a broader look at whether or not we can use artificial intelligence and machine learning methods to improve the performance of those preseason forecasts over time. Now, artificial intelligence and machine learning has gone through a tremendous expansion in the last 20 years as computers and methods have improved, and now machine learning is extensively used in a wide variety of fields. Everything from weather forecasting to predicting financial markets to recognizing patterns in images, or you know, even predicting the next thing you're going to buy on Amazon, whether you like it or not. Machine learning is everywhere. And while there's a wide variety of different machine learning methods, each with their own purpose and attributes, the underlying objective is really to allow the data we have in hand to define complex and often nonlinear relationships between what we see and what we want to predict. So over the past few years, we've really taken a directed look at whether or not we can borrow some of these artificial intelligence and machine learning methods from other fields and implement them in two ways in Bristol Bay. The first is to evaluate whether or not they can improve preseason run size forecasts, so predicting how many fish are coming back next year by age class and river system. And also, we're beginning some efforts to look at whether or not we can leverage these methods to improve predictions for run timing based on environmental conditions and patterns in recent years. You might say, why do we care about run timing? One of the major reasons, in addition to giving some idea when you want to have your boat in the water or when we want to be ready to process fish, is that year-to-year differences in run timing are one of the key challenges in updating our run size forecasts in season. Throughout the season, we also do go through an in-season forecasting process where we try to update our preseason predictions based on what we've seen arrive inshore in terms of catch and escapement and what's been caught out in the Port Muller test fishery. And generally, those methods for in-season forecasting tend to be pretty sensitive to differences from year-to-year in run timing. Generally, when the run timing is early, we tend to over-forecast. And generally, when run timing is late, we tend to under-forecast. So seeing whether or not we can come up with a decent estimate of run timing prior to the season has some value.
Is there anything that you've learned from looking at the run timing aspect of it thus far? I know when you guys had kind of given us the summary of the overall forecasting size, that you had, you know, to what extent did you find that you could improve the existing models? And have you learned anything yet about maybe what improvements could be made to run timing estimates?
Sure. Yeah, before we dive into what we found, I think it's important to describe what we might think of as kind of the traditional methods for forecasting salmon abundance here in Bristol Bay, and those are what are called the sibling or cohort models. And it's basically using the relationship between the abundance of different age classes from the same river that return in different years to predict one another. You know, for example, if the number of 1-2s that return to a river this year is high, those are fish that spent 1 year in freshwater, 2 years in the ocean. This is a pretty good indicator that the number of 1-3s, number of fish that spent 3 years in the ocean returning next year, will be in high abundance as well. You know, a couple of the key things that we found by looking at a range of machine learning methods are, first, that you know, allowing these relationships amongst age classes to evolve over time seems to improve forecast performance. That's sort of to say that accounting for the fact that the percent of individuals spending 2 years at sea versus 3 years at sea might be changing over time, or accounting for the fact that average survival in the ocean might change over time, does seem to have some benefit in terms of improving the reliability of forecasts. The other key thing that we found is that there's benefit in sharing information amongst river systems. So rather than just using different age classes within the same river system to predict one another, to predict run size for one another, if we look across river systems, there does seem to be a signal that, for example, if Igigik run size was large last year, this suggests that survival was good for Ugashik-bound fish as well, and we might expect a decent number of Ugashik fish the next year. The other thing that we've found is that, you know, looking across alternative methods for forecasting, there's really no silver bullet. that for each of the kind of 36 individual forecasts we do, that's the 9 major river systems and the 4 major age classes, there's a different model type that seems to perform well for different ages and different river systems. And so the process that we go through, which is to look at each of these river by age class relationships and evaluate with which forecast model has had the best performance over the past 20 to 30 year period, seems like it is the best way to go about generating forecasts in the future.
You know, those are really interesting, and talking about the improvements that you guys have been able to see how you can tweak these models to perform better, Curry. Is there anything that you've been able to, is there any possible way to improve run timing estimates? I know that work is still underway and a lot of it is yet to come, but, you know, what could you say about that, about timing of the run?
Sure. So you're exactly right. We're just kicking off a concerted research effort to improve or evaluate whether or not we can improve estimates for run timing prior to the season. What we do know is that on the preseason end, there's kind of relatively weak relationships between sea surface temperature in the months leading up to when fish arrive inshore, so March, April, and May, and run timing. They're not great, but it does suggest that there may be some environmental linkage out there that may provide some information. On the in-season end, what we found over time is that the best predictor of run timing or when fish are arriving inshore is when we see kind of the peak in fish passing out through the Port Muller test fishery. So leveraging both pre-season and in-season information may give us a better basis on which to predict when fish are likely to arrive inshore for Bristol Bay as a whole and on a district-by-district basis, which of course helps us improve our estimates of how many fish we might see at the end of the year.
Well, excellent. I'm sure fishermen will be staying tuned, staying tuned for more info on that. And as you guys find answers, we'll try to get them to the fleet and make sure there's that connection going on. I wanted to talk about the otolith mapping project. This is really fascinating research that Dr. Schindler's been involved with and heading up. Daniel, could you explain to people, how do you map otoliths and what does it allow us to do? What does it allow us to learn?
Yeah, I guess should start with the motivation for this research. Our long-term work on places like the Wood River, where we can pretty easily get throughout the system and survey the spawning grounds. You know, over the last 50, 60 years, one of the things we've come to appreciate is that different parts of the watershed are important for producing fish at times that are often different years than in other parts of the watershed. So sometimes the upper Wood River lakes, for instance, may be producing a lot of salmon, and in other decades or in other years, the lower lakes are more important for producing the sockeye that return to the river. With the otoliths, we were really asking the same type of question about what part of the watershed was most important at different periods of time. But the Nooshogak is a very different, the upper Nooshogak is a very different system than the Wood River. It's mostly riverine. It's huge. It's basically too large and too complex to put a team of people on the ground and count the fish in their spawning grounds. So instead, we used a bit of a trick where we take the ear stones out of the heads of fish that have been caught. In the case of sockeye, Alaska Department of Fish and Game has been doing that sampling for us at the Portage Creek site. And what we do there is take those otoliths out of their head, and they're an ear stone that the fish has when it's born from the egg, and it slowly accumulates growth on this little stone inside its head. And as it grows, it incorporates the chemistry of the water that it's swimming around in, and in particular, the chemicals that it absorbs in proportion to their abundance in the water is element we call strontium. And for a watershed like the Nooshagak, there is a lot of variation from certain parts of the watershed to others in terms of how much and what type of strontium is in the water. So basically what we can do is take that otolith out of a fish that's caught as an adult turning back to the river. We don't know where it came from, but by blasting the center of its otolith with a laser, we can sample what type of strontium is in it, and then use that basically as a fingerprint to place that fish on the map in terms of where it was produced from within the river system. And RSDA funded us to do some of this work. A postdoc named Sean Brennan was really the person who led that work until his tragic passing a couple years ago. But really the motivation there was asking the question about what parts of the Nooshagak River were most important for producing sockeye and for producing Chinook salmon. And really the key result that's emerging from it is very similar to the same results we're getting by studying fish, by counting them by foot, which is that in some years, the upper Tikchik lakes are very important for producing sockeye, and in other years, it's the lower river that's most important for producing sockeye. And in the case of Chinook salmon or kings, sometimes it's the west part of the watershed, and sometimes it's the east part of the watershed that's the most important in terms of producing the fish that are returning in any given year. So really what it tells us is that it's the entire watershed and all of its habitat that produces reliable runs from year to year, because sometimes certain pieces are important and then other times other pieces of the watershed are important.
Right. So what you're saying is that upriver, the different tributaries and habitats that feed into the larger river, the production is a lot more inconsistent, but because there's a wider variety of habitats that might do better or worse under different conditions, that kind of the run going out and the run coming in tends to be more consistent because you've got a more diverse set of habitat conditions, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Andy. So, the complexity across the entire watershed really stabilizes how many fish come back from year to year. And in the case of the sockeye work, one of the things that's interesting is really, how many of those sockeye that are being caught in the Nooshagak fishing district were produced from those upper lakes. If you look at a map, you realize there's a lot of lake habitat in the upper Nooshagak, but per unit of lake area, on average, they don't really produce that many sockeye. And one possibility for that may be that they're so cold that they're not very, what we call, productive. They don't have a lot of food for juvenile salmon. And it's possible that with some of these record returns we're seeing coming back to the Nooshagak, like we are seeing this year, that may actually be a reflection of the fact those upper lakes are starting to warm up to the point where they're going to start producing more fish in the future than they have in the past. Again, this type of approach will allow us to answer that type of question, because otherwise it would take an army of people to really get out and distribute across the watershed and count fish in all different parts of the system. If we go back to Ray's introduction to our program, we started in 1946, and that was after a decade or two of really low salmon production in Bristol Bay. And there was concern among the fleets and among the fishing processors that maybe they were over exploiting the fisheries because there certainly weren't as many fish returning as there were a couple decades before that. We now have the benefit of hindsight, and what we do know is that time period in the 30s and 40s was actually a relatively cold time period when salmon production was really low in Western Alaska. And then by the 1970s, we shifted into a warmer climate condition where salmon abundance at least doubled in western Alaska, including in Bristol Bay. And then since the mid-1990s and into the 2000s, it seems like we're taking this one further step up towards increased warming yet. And, you know, the fact that we've seen 50 million fish return to Bristol Bay for each of the last, 6 or 7 years now, if you told someone that in the 40s, they simply would have laughed at you. And, you know, it's pretty clear that, you know, we don't know what the mechanisms are, but it's pretty clear that this increased production of sockeye in Bristol Bay is some complex response to climate warming. And places that sockeye inhabit south of the Alaska Peninsula down the Gulf of Alaska and through British Columbia during this last decade have done really poorly. And that's been correlated with these exceptionally, in fact, unprecedented warm conditions in the North Pacific. So if you look at where is the bright spot for salmon globally, for wild salmon globally, you know, the arrow points directly at Bristol Bay. You know, the number of fish that these watersheds are producing now is simply would not have been believable a few decades ago. And it's, you know, year after year, we're seeing now another 50 million fish come back. So, yeah, who knows what the future is going to hold. But if you look at the watersheds, you look at the rivers and the lakes, they continue to warm up, but they're nowhere near what we would consider a tipping point for getting too warm to support sockeye. So now is the time we should be doubling down on investments in Bristol Bay fisheries, in protecting the habitat that produces all those fish, in terms of the effects of climate change on salmon. Yeah, Bristol Bay is certainly a shining star at a global scale.
I wanted to talk to Ray a little bit about the life cycle assessment project and the work that he's done there to better understand the impact of the industry and, you know, how many CO2 emissions and what the environmental impact is of commercial fishing in Bristol Bay. And so Ray, can you give people a little bit of, you know, some info about what that project's been about and what you found?
Sure. There's a lot of interest in the environmental impacts of fishing and almost all human activities across a range of measures. And the one that is most common and I'll concentrate on is the carbon footprint. So the basic question is, what's the carbon footprint of producing a pound of Bristol Bay sockeye salmon, and how does that compare to comparing a pound of beef or chicken or pork, or the same caloric or nutrient contents from soybeans or other fishes? And there's been quite an extensive literature on this. The process is called life cycle assessment, and it's the process of working out everything that goes into producing a product such as a salmon or a pig, et cetera. And with the assistance from BBRSDA, we've been looking at that for Bristol Bay sockeye salmon. And I'm working with two teams of essentially specialists in the process of LCA. It's a pretty deep field. There's specialty software you need, and so my end of it has been to collect data from fishing companies and fishing fleets primarily for this. Fuel use is the dominant thing that goes into it, but we're just getting ready to publish the work. And the picture is Bristol Bay salmon looks really, really quite good. The amount of carbon produced for catching and processing Bristol Bay salmon is basically distinctly less than the competitors in the livestock business, and generally quite a bit better than most fisheries on average, although there are some fisheries that do better. But the purpose is to give the industry another lever in promoting the sustainability and the low environmental impact of their product. Some of the fish rating systems like Monterey Bay are exploring using carbon footprint as one of their measures of what's a good choice and what's a bad choice. But Bristol Bay looks good. And the reason's pretty simple. The fish come to Bristol Bay. You don't have to go out and search for them on the ocean. Interestingly, the footprint and getting them to the dock is about half for the fleet and about half for the tenders. That the tenders are about half of that footprint, and then that gets the fish to the dock, and then the processing is roughly comparable to the catching and delivery in terms of the total carbon footprint. And I don't have the numbers for any of these fake meats or fake fish, but I do know that Bristol Bay sockeye are about half the carbon footprint of the Impossible Burger, supposedly this vegetarian, better environmental product than a regular hamburger. And we'll be as soon as there's some LCAs available on all the fake meats that are coming. I mean, the fake fish that are coming out. We'll be looking at those.
Well, that's so interesting, because I think if you listen to the media and you see what's being written about farming and fishing and plant-based proteins, the impression that a lot of people probably get is that fishing is not good for the environment. Sustainable farming is the way to go. And you could probably lump, some people would lump fish farming into that. But there's a lot that, there's a lot of environmental impacts that go into feeding fish, raising crops to feed animals. And so is the fact that Bristol Bay has a low environmental impact, is that largely driven by the sort of feed component and the land use component?
Yeah, when you compare it to livestock, that's definitely, if you one of the studies teams I'm working with were comparing farm salmon to wild salmon, and farm salmon have about twice the footprint of production that is catching and processing than wild Alaska salmon, and most of the cost of farm salmon in terms of carbon is the feed it takes to produce them. And we haven't been able to quantify it yet, but if you look at the impact on just general biodiversity, Bristol Bay fishery is one of the cleanest fisheries in the world. There's very, very little bycatch. But if you look at where a lot of the farm salmon feed comes from, it's coming from growing soybeans by chopping down rainforest or savannas and converting habitats. So, almost across the board, wild salmon is very hard to beat in terms of a low environmental impact.
Well, it's probably something that's, not maybe news to a lot of fishermen that fish in Bristol Bay, but I think that a lot of consumers out there are going to find that, news to them, because like you said, it's maybe not apparent that things like soybean meal are being used to feed farm salmon, and certainly it takes a lot of carbon, a lot of fuel to chase down all the forage fish that also goes into the feed, and you don't get farm salmon without those feed ingredients, and there is an impact to that. So it's probably easy to think about the diesel that gets burned fishing in Bristol Bay, but because there's so much scale and it's spread out over so many fish, the impact per pound is relatively low compared to the things that you've studied, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
it's definitely a selling point for the Bristol Bay fish, but it's true for pretty well all of the pink salmon from other parts of Alaska are also quite efficiently caught and processed. So Alaska salmon looks good in general. Bristol Bay probably isn't much different than any other of the major salmon fisheries in Alaska.
Yeah, and I should point out that this wasn't something that we sort of pursued as thinking about, can we be the first to have a life cycle assessment of this fish or this product, right? We're really hearing a lot of retailers and buyers and consumers out there in the world that are asking, what is the environmental impact of this product or this protein? And it's something that's being done in a lot of other, for a lot of other animals, a lot of other industries. So it really just made sense that we should fill in that gap. Dr. Hilborn and his team are best in the biz at doing that. And so how have you seen the development of industries or companies looking to answer these questions about environmental impact?
Oh yeah, it's a booming field. I'm also involved in another project looking at the Bering Sea pollock fishery, pretty well most of the big fishing industries around the world are getting involved in life cycle assessments, because as you said, their customers are wanting to know, and carbon just turns out to be one that usually is on top of everybody's list and actually is one of the easiest ones to quantify. So that's quite convenient.
Well, thank you so much.
Ray,
go ahead.
Oh, I was going to suggest Ray should say something about the fact that food production in general is one of the most environmentally harmful things that humanity does, and what that's caused is the fact that consumers are much pickier now about what food they buy, depending on what its reputation is in terms of its environmental impact.
Certainly, discriminating consumers in countries that pay the most for fish, so essentially North America and Europe are the primary ones, are increasingly concerned about the environmental impact of their fish, and often they have very distorted perspectives. So, it's almost always assumed that plant-based foods are better, that is, lower environmental impact than particularly wild-based fisheries. And it's just so not true that, outside of the context of LCA, one of the things we've been doing is just looking at how fish and other foods are produced and what their impacts is. And one of the most interesting things is that fish is quite maligned because no form of industrial agriculture would ever meet the Marine Stewardship Council standards that fisheries try to attain. And you're never going to achieve that with corn or soybeans. They couldn't come close to meeting the standard that you do not alter the structure and function of the ecosystem. So that's just another part of our research, is trying to get that message out that fisheries have considerably lower environmental impacts than plant-based foods. And I'll just also say thanks to BBRSDA for its support on our projects. And it's a real privilege to work with Bristol Bay Fishery and all the fishermen in the Bay. And good luck with the rest of the season.
Well, thank you guys so much. Your research, your work helps keep this fishery abundant and sustainable, which, as I said at the beginning, is really what makes Bristol Bay so special. So I'm very happy to work together. And that's about all the time we have for today. So on behalf of BBRSDA and the Commercial Drift Fleet, I want to thank Curry, Daniel, and Ray for making time for us today. And invite you to tune in next Thursday afternoon at 12:30 for our next episode of Waypoints Radio. Until then, good fishing and good luck.